has anyone given any thought to whether we're going to be able to use that little Johnny Cash bit?
And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight we've assembled another fabulous panel to talk about a fabulous revelation. This is another in our Dummies series. Once again, the Dummies are us, and we will be trying to take a walk through some historical document of significance to the church. And today we are talking about the White Horse Prophecy, which is interesting on many, many levels. So I've been really looking forward to this. First of all, seated to my left is the wonderful Zilpha. Hey, Zilpha.
Hello, John. Hey, everybody.
Hello. And then from the four corners of the nation, first of all, we have Troy. Hey, Troy.
Hey. I'm glad to be back.
You're starting to become quite the regular, aren't you?
Well, I've been on a few recently, so I think this is my third.
Well, good.
And yeah, it's great. Fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And Matthew. Hey, Matthew, welcome back.
Hello, delighted to be here.
The pleasure is mine, and of course our illustrious listeners. And returning, it's from a short absence, is Jesse. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, how you doing? Good to be here.
Now, Jesse, in the real world, you're an attorney, right?
Yes.
So we have a trio of the three wise men of attorneys.
Well, John, didn't you say something like the podcast is being taken over by attorneys and women? So now you're officially
yes.
The only non-attorney and non-woman.
He's outnumbered.
I like to argue,
sure.
And I'm kind of girly. So I think I classify in all categories. I transcend all. Okay. So the White Horse Prophecy. This thing is, it's something that everybody can quote from, but most people don't know is out there, and most people have never read it. As a matter of fact, until the last few days preparing for this, I had never read it. Have any of you actually read the White Horse Prophecy before this point?
First time for me too.
No.
Me too. Yes, I have never read it.
But there was there anything in there that wasn't familiar or that you hadn't heard from some place at one time or the other?
Yeah,
there were a few screwball things, but the general gist of it I'd heard of. But I think some of the more specific nitty gritty things that the audience will hear there will be new.
All right, we're gonna play you a dramatized reading of the White Horse Prophecy in just a minute here. It's not that long, but before we jump into that, let's go into it. You know, before can I start out the whole thing with a tangent? I need to wag my finger at the apologists again. Okay, the words supposedly and so-called have no place in any sort of scholarly work. You can't find an apologist, and I read through all their stuff, and some of them have some good stuff on this White Horse Prophecy, but they love to drop in those insult words. It's not supposedly, or the so-called White Horse Prophecy. It is the White Horse Prophecy. Now, whether or not it is a valid prophecy is a legitimate question. But the so-called, if I called everything so-called, the apologists would be up in arms and insulted. So I'm just telling you guys to stop using those fighting words.
John, I'm going to dogpile with you just for a second because, and point specifically at the Fair article on this, which actually I thought was one of their better articles.
It was a good article if you take out all that sort of stuff. I agree. Go ahead.
I thought it was fair. Well, I was just going to say that the guy says, you know, makes the case that, you know, there is not provenance or that he doesn't find credible this Rushton story. And, you know, about two thirds of the way through the article begins to call it the discredited Rushton story. Not because he's pointed to anything else, but because he said he doesn't like it. So now it's the discredited Rushton story.
Well, and we'll get to this point too, but there is a problem with a lot of the prophecies. Joseph Smith actually wrote very little in his own hand. And there's a sleight of hand game, and you guys are all going to hear about the story behind this one in a second so you can evaluate how real it is. But there's a sleight of hand game where the apologists like to call in question anything that they can't tie directly to Joseph Smith, which, of course, in later years is hardly anything. I mean, there were no recording devices. So I've seen apologists call into question the Journal of Discourse, which was, of course, recorded by professional stenographers, and things like the writing about the Kinderhook plates, which we're going to talk about in a few weeks here. But even though the same guy who wrote about the Kinderhook plates, for example, is the author of more than one revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants. So if you're going to cast dispersion on things, know that whatever net you cast is going to catch a lot more fish than you want it to catch. I'm fine with that, saying, hey, we can only take revelation that we have in Joseph Smith's own handwriting, but we're going to lose a lot of what the church is founded on.
Well, and the other problem is that they say, I mean, the Fair article says this, and I read this a couple other places too. You start with the explanation of, well, look, here's how real prophecy comes down. Here's how doctrine comes down. And it comes from the first presidency, or it comes from the president of the church. Only that's anachronistic to Joseph Smith's time. That there was not a mechanism that existed for that then. And there hasn't been any revelation since then. So that's the way it comes down, only that it doesn't happen that way anymore.
Right, right. They give this standard saying, this is the only way to get revelation. But like DNC 132, when that was swapped out and put into the Doctrine and Covenants in, what, 1879, didn't follow any of those rules. So
right.
You know, if you're going to say this is not a valid revelation on those grounds, you're going to have to deal with others. Now, that all being said, I agree that this has shaky history. And there's some problems with this thing that I'm going to point out. But let's go ahead and give the backstory. This is written first person in the hand of Edwin Rushton. And the story that you'll hear in a minute has Edwin Rushton and Theodore Turley. Does anybody know, is he related? He has to be related to church historian Turley.
Church. I don't know, but John, I don't think Rushton wrote it himself. I think others wrote it down.
It was written down.
Wrong about that?
I thought it was an agent, someone who came there that was interviewing him, that was interviewing Rushton, was the one who recorded it. But I don't have the handwritten copy that you have, John. And I did see that there was a copy that someone was quoting from that said it was written in his own hand and signed by him at the bottom. Was that the copy you have?
Yeah, so I'm,
okay, I haven't seen that.
I'm looking at BYU Studies 49 from last year, where Don L. Penrod wrote an excellent article on the source from the White Horse Prophecy, in which he has a photostatic copy of the oldest version. So the story of where we got this is Joseph Smith in 1843 was talking to these two fellas, Theodore Turley and Edwin Rushton. And Edwin Rushton is the one who supposedly wrote it down. Edwin Rushton went to Salt Lake City, I think as did Turley, but Turley never mentioned this thing at all, where he was a 70, he was a high priest and a bishopric, and he died in full fellowship in 1904. That's important because the story is that Rushton, and this is what Penrod in BYU Studies gives, Rushton wrote down the revelation sometime between about 1890 and 1902, and that Rushton gave it to the patriarch John Smith, who at the time was considered a prophet, seer, and revelator. And Penrod pretty much argues that most of the copies trace their lineage back to that. The church has some copies in their vault, but the original is in private hands, and he didn't identify who has it. So it was Romney, maybe. I don't know. It was handed out, and the earliest version that we can trace to anything appears in the Journal of John J. Roberts, dated March 2nd, 1902, and that's the copy that's in this BYU Studies one, and that's the text that we're going to go from. So there were likely versions before that, but Roberts apparently copied it into his journal on 1902. So the earliest we can trace it back to is 1902, and it's probably circa 1890 to 1902.
And just to be clear, the reason that we're going through the provenance of this is to highlight the point that the apologists are making, that this supposedly came from 1843, but we don't have a contemporaneous copy of it that was recorded then. It wasn't recorded in, you know, the Revelation book or, you know, any minutes from the time or anything like that. So the provenance of this entire revelation is in question.
Yes, and I would agree with them here. This is problematic, just as other things are problematic. I'll give you another example, something that's just like this. The appearance of Joseph Smith in the Nauvoo Temple after his death, when Brigham Young was transformed or before people's eyes to be the face and presence of Joseph Smith. Likewise, there are no contemporary accounts of that. And those start appearing much later, I think as much as 20 years later before people start talking about that. But of all the accounts of that event firsthand, no one records anything of the sort happening. But this one, there's some things where Brigham Young says, we'll talk about here after we read through it, where people have quoted other things that are in this and attributed them from Joseph Smith. My guess is that, this was written by Rushton in his later years, and Penrod argues that when you compare the handwriting samples from earlier in Rushton's life, it's written in more shakier hand, so it's likely that he wrote it when he was older, although the handwriting samples match. Robert's hand. It's likely that the elderly gentleman writing this was conflaborating. What's the word there? Conflating. Multiple things that he had heard, and it was probably exaggerated over time because it was written 50 to 60 years after the event took place.
But it is pretty clear that at least some of the things that are written in this prophecy were actually said by Joseph Smith.
Undoubtedly. Okay, so that's sort of the background of it.
John, did you just teach us a new word, conflaborating? Yes. When you can conflate something and exaggerate at the same time?
Yes, conflaboration. As a matter of fact, the word conflaboration is, in fact, a conflaboration.
That sounds like that should have been on the sex podcast.
There was no conflaboration there. Okay, so
that's disappointing.
Without any further ado, let's go ahead and read it now.
On about the 6th of May, 1843, a grand review of the Nauvoo Legion was held in Nauvoo. The prophet Joseph Smith complimented them for their good discipline and evolutions performed. The weather being hot, he called for a glass of water. With the glass of water in hand, he said, "I will drink to you a toast to the overthrow of the Mobocrats," which he did in the following language. "Here's wishing they were in the middle of the sea, in a stone canoe with iron paddles, and that a shark swallowed the canoe, and the devil swallowed the shark, and himself locked up in the northwest corner of hell, the key lost and a blind man hunting it." The next morning, a man who had heard the prophet gave the toast returned to the visit of the mansion of the prophet, and so abused him with bad language, that he was ordered out by the prophet. It was while the two were out that my attention was attracted to them, and hearing the man speaking in a loud tone of voice, I went towards them, the man finally leaving. There were present the prophet, Theodore Turley, and myself, Edwin Rushton. The prophet began talking to us of the mobbings and the deriding and the persecutions we as a people had been endured. "But we will have worse things to see. Our persecutors will have all the mobbings they want. Don't wish them any harm, for when you see their sufferings, you will shed bitter tears for them." When this conversation was going on, we stood by the south wicket gate in a triangle. Turning to me, he said, "I want to tell you something of the future. I will speak to you in parable, like unto John the Revelator. You will go to the Rocky Mountains. You will be a great and mighty people established there, which I will call the White Horse of Peace and Safety." When the prophet said, "You will see it," I said, "Where will you be at the time?" He said, "I shall never go there. Your enemies will continue to follow you with persecutions, and they will make obnoxious laws against you in Congress to destroy the right horse. But you will have a friend or two to defend you and throw out the worst parts of the law, so they will not hurt you so much. You must continue to petition Congress all the time, but they will treat you like strangers and aliens, and they will not give you your rights, but will govern you with the strangers and commissioners. You will see the Constitution of the United States almost destroyed. It will hang like a thread, as fine as a silk fiber." At that time, the prophet's countenance became sad, because he said, "I love the Constitution. It was made by the inspiration of God, and it will be preserved and saved by the efforts of the White Horse, and by the Red Horse, who will come to combine in its defense. The White Horse will find the mountains full of minerals, and they will become rich. You will see silver piled up in the streets. You will see gold shoveled up like sand. Gold will be one of little value then, even in the mercantile capacity, for the people of the world will have something else to do in seeking for salvation. The time will come when the banks of every nation will fail, and only two places will be safe where people can deposit their gold and treasure. This place will be the White Horse and England's vaults. A terrible revolution will take place in the land of America, such as never been seen before. For the land will be left without a supreme government, and every species of wickedness will be practiced rampantly in the land. Father will be against son, and son against father, mother against daughter, and daughter against mother. The most terrible scenes of bloodshed, murder, and rape that have ever been imagined or looked upon will take place. People will be taken from the earth, and there will be peace and love, and only in the Rocky Mountains. This will cause many hundreds of thousands of the honest in heart of the world to gather there, not because they would be saints, but for safety, and because they will be so numerous that you will be in danger of famine, but not for want of seed, time, and harvest, but because of so many to be fed. Many will come with bundles under their arms to escape the calamities, for there will be no escape except only by escaping and fleeing to Zion. Those that come to you will try to keep the laws and be one with you, for they will see your unity and greatness of your organization. The Turkish Empire of the Crescent will be the first power to be disputed, for freedom must be given to the gospel and be preached in the Holy Land. The Lord took of the best blood of the nations and planted them in the small islands now called England and Great Britain, and gave them power in the nations of 1,000 years. And their power will continue with them, that they may keep the balance of power, and they will keep Russia from sweeping her power over the world. England and France are now bitter enemies, but they will be allied together and be united to keep Russia from conquering the world. The two popes, Greek and Catholic, will eventually come together in their decline and become united. The Protestant religions do not know how much they are indebted to Henry VIII. For throwing off the Pope's bill and establishing the Protestant faith. He was the only monarch who could do so at the time, and he did it because the nation was at his back to sustain him. One of the peculiar features in England is that its established red coat, a uniform making so remarkable a target to shoot at, and yet they have conquered wherever they have gone. The reason for this will be known to them someday, as red is seen in a different color, threading through under all history. The lion and the unicorn of England comes, and there being so much blood of Israel in the nation. While the terrible things of which I have mentioned are going on, England will be neutral until it becomes so inhumane that she will interfere to stop the shedding of the blood, and the history will be more properly understood. England and France will unite together to make peace, not to subdue nations. She will find a nation so broken up and so many claiming government, till there will be no reasonable government. Then it will appear on the other nation or powers as though England had taken possession of the country. The Black Horse will flee to the invaders and will join them, for they have fear of becoming slaves again. Knowing that England did not believe in slavery, they will flee to them that they believe will make them safe. armed with British bayonets, the doings of the Black Horse will be terrible. Here the prophet said that he could not bear to look longer upon the scenes as shown to him in the vision, and he asked the Lord to close the scenes. Continuing, he said, during this time the great white horse will have gathered strength, sending out elders to gather the honest in heart from among the pale horse, or people of the United States, to stand by the Constitution of the United States as it was given by the inspiration of God. In these days which are yet to come, God will set up a kingdom never to be thrown down, but other kingdoms to come into it. And those kingdoms that will not let the gospel be preached in their lands will be humbled until they will. England, the Germany, Norway, Denmark, Switzerland, Holland, and Belgium have a considerable amount of blood on Israel among the people which must be gathered out. Those nations will submit to the nations of God. England will be the last of the nations to surrender, but when she does, she will do it as a whole in comparison. And she threw off the Catholic power. The nobility knows that the gospel is true, but it is not prompt enough and grandeur and influence for them yet to embrace it. They are proud and will not acknowledge the kingdom of God or come into it until they see the power it will have. Peace and safety in the Rocky Mountains will be protected by the guardians, the white horse and red horses. Coming from the Messiah among his people will be so natural that only those who see him will know that he has come. But he will come and give his law unto Zion and minister unto his people. This will not be his coming in the clouds of heaven to take vengeance on the wicked of the world. The temple in Jackson County, Missouri will be built in that generation. The saints will think that there will not be time to build it, but with all the help you can receive, you can put up a great temple quickly. You have all the gold, silver, and precious stones you need, for these things will only be for the beautifying of the temple. Also, all the skilled mechanics you want, and the 10 tribes of Israel will help build it. When you see this land bound with iron, you may look forward to Jackson County. At this point, he made pause. Looking up as though the vision were still in view, he said, there is a land beyond the Rocky Mountains that will be invaded by the heathen Chinese unless we care and protect be given. Speaking of the heathen nations, he said, where there is no law, there is no condemnation. This will apply to them. Power will be given to the white horse to rebuke the nations afar off, and you obey it, for the laws go forth from Zion. The last great struggle that Zion will ever have to contend with will be when the whole of America will be made the Zion of God. The opposing will be called Gog and Magog. The nations of the earth will be led by the Russian Tsar, and his power will be great. But all opposition will be overcome, and this land will be the Zion of our God. Amen.
Okay, so there you go, the White Horse Prophecy. Let's talk about, before we get into the text or that you all just heard, let's talk about the denunciation of this thing. I want to read you, I was referring earlier to this, Penrod article. I want to read you his denunciation of this thing. I want to read you, the denunciation from President Joseph F. Smith. Around about 1918, the church first came out and publicly started saying this thing is garbage. Joseph Fielding Smith, he denounced it, then Joseph F. Smith did so. Joseph F. Smith was his father. And this was Joseph F. Smith's words. The ridiculous story about the red horse and the black horse and the white horse and a lot of trash that has been circulated about and printed and sent around as a great revelation given by the prophet Joseph Smith is a matter which was gotten up, I understand, some 10 years after the death of the prophet Joseph Smith by two of our brethren who put together some broken sentences from the prophet that they may have heard him utter from time to time and formulated this so-called revelation out of it, and it was never spoken by the prophet in the manner in which they have put it forth. It is simply false. That is all there is to it. Now, I love this quote for several reasons. First of all, most of his text there validates it, right? He says it was 10 years after these guys heard it from Joseph Smith. They're broken sentences from the prophet that had been uttered from time to time. And he just says it was never spoken of in this manner. And then he says it's simply false. I like this because the people who quote it, the apologists and such, tend to ignore that this quote sort of gives it validity and gives a backstory to this that that they deny. Because Joseph F. Smith had been around for this. He was a boy at the time, but he would have grown up during this time when people would have been spoken about this. And he doesn't say this is a recent fiction. You know, he attributes back to the time or shortly thereafter after the prophet went. So I really like this because I think it gives a little bit of credence to the ideas that they obviously weren't foreign to Smith.
Well, John, 5 years before that, he himself said that Joseph Smith, the prophet, was inspired to affirm and ratify this truth. And he further predicated that the time would come when the Constitution of our country would hang as it were by a thread, and that the Latter-day Saints above all other people in the world would come to the rescue of that great and glorious palladium, I think that's the word, of our liberty. And that was in 1912, 5 years before he said it wasn't legitimate.
But that doesn't necessarily attribute to the White Horse prophecy.
Right. So I think that, though, is one of the examples of the Constitution would hang by a thread as being believed of as coming from Joseph Smith.
Okay, so this is a good time to make the distinction between two things here. There's the prophecy, or there's the idea that the Constitution would hang by the thread, and maybe that some members of the church or the church itself would have a duty or a role in restoring the Constitution. I think that's one thing. And then the second thing is the actual White Horse prophecy itself, which is what was just read in its entirety. You know, that specific account. So I think when the prophet or the church authorities are denouncing the quote, White Horse prophecy, they're talking about these, you know, specific goofy things in here, the Black Horse and the White Horse and England and France and, you know, the Iron Canoe and all of that. so that's what they're talking about. They're not talking, I haven't seen a denunciation of the idea that the Constitution will hang by a thread and the elders of Israel will rush in to save it. I haven't seen one quote or one piece of evidence that says that the church authorities don't believe that part of it. And there's plenty of quotes ratifying that parts of it from all the way from Brigham Young up until, you know, fairly recently with church leaders affirming that portion of the White Horse prophecy, which I think to most people, when they hear the White Horse prophecy, that's what they're thinking of. They're not necessarily thinking of all the esoteric parts of the long quote that we just had read into this episode.
So, yeah, to validate, in 1854 in the Tabernacle from the Journal of Discourse, Brigham Young actually said that Joseph Smith, he attributed this directly to Joseph Smith, that the Constitution would hang by a thread. So the idea that the Constitution hanging by a thread had clearly been around and been consistent before this revelation ever came out, which is why when the White Horse prophecy came out, it was clearly in line with things that other people had already said.
Should we talk about the link to Revelations and how?
Let's stay on the Constitution and Elders thing before we go to Revelations. So let's go back in history a little bit, the church history and then the world history. Joseph Smith, before he died, had become increasingly political. And Nauvoo was basically founded as a religious political state. John C. Bennett was the first mayor, but after Bennett was run out of town, Joseph Smith took that role himself. And Joseph Smith was also the general of the Nauvoo Legion. And, you know, he paraded around. He wore his military garb, and he exercised full political action. Of course, the sacking of the Nauvoo Expositor was done under the auspice of government, and everything had sort of come together. And with the Council of 50, Joseph Smith had set up this organization that was in place really to become the next world government, with the idea that at some point Jesus would come down and seize the reins. But the Mormon Church was going to set up this empire, this kingship on earth that would eventually be handed over to Jesus as the perfect king. And Joseph Smith had himself crowned by the Council of 50 as king of the world. And he had decided to run for presidency, which is when Joseph Smith was assassinated. Everybody knows from church history that the 12 were all out of town. What they don't tell you in the church manuals is they were all out of town campaigning for Joseph Smith's presidency. They weren't on missions. They were on a political mission. So during the summer of 44, the political sweep was well in place, and that idea started by Joseph Smith was continued by Brigham Young, who set up a kingdom in the West. And he taught and clearly believed that the government of the United States and the world would sort of fall down around their knees. And the only thing that would be left standing was this theocracy in Salt Lake City. So this idea was really started by Joseph Smith and continued by Brigham Young, who act with complete autocratic, unchallenged authority.
But it wasn't sort of separate from, you know, the American government or the American ideal or constitution. I think from what I've read, beginning in that Nauvoo period and then carrying out to the West, they begin to see themselves as the protectors of the Constitution and sort of the last real Americans. So it's not that they're separate, you know, I mean, they're physically separating themselves out, but it's almost like they see themselves as the torch carrier for those ideas as, you know, sort of the world abandons it.
There's a really good quote from the history of the church, 1843. And this was recorded there. This is a speech that Joseph Smith gave. He said, "I prophesy in the name of the Lord God of Israel, unless the United States redress the wrongs committed upon the saints in the state of Missouri and punish the crimes committed by her officers, that in a few years the government will be utterly overthrown and wasted. And there will not be so much as a potsherd. What is that word?
Potsherd
left for their wickedness in permitting the murder of men, women, and children, and the wholesale plunger." That's what it says. Plunger. "And extermination of thousands of her citizens to go unpunished."
Yeah.
Thereby.
Go ahead.
Well, it was just one more thing. "Thereby perpetuated a foul and corroding blot upon the fair name of this great republic."
Yeah, so I think it's really clear that for the church at this time, the Constitution and their status, the church relating to the law, was fresh on their mind. John, you mentioned the Joseph Smith running for president. He started campaigning in January of 44, I believe, and this was May of 43. And I did a little bit of digging here, and I found some other events that also happened in May of 1843. Can I just run through a quick list here?
Sure.
Yeah.
Kind of to give some context. This was supposedly the White Horse Prophecy was from May 6th of 1843. So May 1st of 1843, Joseph married Lucy Walker. She was 17. May 11th of 1843, he married Maria Lawrence and her sister Sarah Lawrence. They were 19 and 17. May 14th.
Giggity?
Yeah, that was my contribution to the podcast so far.
May 15th, Benjamin Johnson reported that Joseph was sleeping with his sister Almira in Ramis, Ohio. And then the next day he wrote DNC Section 131, which says that you have to enter into the new and everlasting covenant in order to be exalted. On May 22nd, Emma discovered Joseph Smith in a private bedroom with Eliza Partridge at their house. And this is when Emma blew up and threw her down the stairs. And then on May 28th was when Joseph Smith and Emma were sealed, of that month. So.
I hope he took a nap after all of that.
Wow.
Well, obviously they had departed from the standard legal practices. And you know, we can go back and see that Joseph Smith had been persecuted from almost the beginning for his non-standard sexual practices, i.e. polygamy. And
that's
so
a kind way to say it.
I do think those things were contributing to his thought pattern.
Well, and he was pretty, I guess you could say, pissed off that they got kicked out of Missouri, because he was putting all of his eggs in that basket, you know, with the Zion and the Adam on Diamond and the temple lot and all that stuff. And then he gets kicked out.
Yeah. So you're right. After they lost Zion, the Mormonism is a restoration movement, but that whole idea of returning to Zion and being restored to their proper place, which of course appears in this revelation, that they'll go back to Missouri and reclaim, it becomes a paramount idea that sort of was big until the demise of polygamy and the setting up a statehood in Utah. And even then, it's just been a slow trickle back. There are Mormons today who still talk about going back to Missouri. So the idea is still out there. But go ahead.
I was going to say, wasn't it in 1838 that he had been to Washington, D.C. to see the then President Van Buren and had tried to get his assistance? It seemed like that he had wanted to set up his own federal charter of some kind. He wanted to be the general of his own army out there so that they could protect themselves. And as I recall, Van Buren told him essentially, and I think this is according to Joseph anyway, well, your cause is just, but if I do that, I'll lose the vote in Missouri. And so sort of ever after that, you begin to not just hear, but other places sort of get the rhetoric of, well, you know, if they're not going to redress our, you know, these wrongs, if we can't count on the government to enforce the Constitution, then, you know, bad things are coming their way. Disaster is going to be upon them before too long.
Right.
And I would go all the way back. There's two threads that are important. The idea that the Constitution and the Founding Fathers were divinely inspired was set up, you know, as early as 1830 in the Book of Mormon. And all through, you know, like the Journal of Discourse period, the period where they were battling for statehood, and that there is a strong patriotism. So there have been people, and I've been included in this, saying after polygamy, the Mormons turned to try to become quasi-essential Americans. But that patriotism and that the same rhetoric you hear from the right wing today about the glorious founding fathers has been through Mormonism consistently. And I think Joseph Smith sort of used that as a rhetorical ploy to say, all right, here we are getting persecuted for our crimes and misdemeanors, you know, which were polygamy and different things like that. But it's because they've departed from the intent of the founding fathers. And of course, later, you know, the founding fathers were all co-opted into the church when they appeared, to the temple president in the St. George Temple and were baptized.
Except Van Buren.
It was later. He just had to wait in purgatory a few more years.
No, really. I think part of that revelation was that he wasn't in it. I'll look that up.
No, you're right. He was not, but they did order his work to be done some year, 50 or 60 years later.
Oh boy.
But I do think it's important that part that you said that, you know, Latter-day Saints believe that the United States is a divinely inspired, government, and that the whole land is a promised land, kind of like Jerusalem.
Well, that's one of the fundamental messages of the Book of Mormon, that American exceptionalism was taken to a religious level with the Book of Mormon, in that, you know, this land, God only leads the righteous here, that he wants to come here, and he's going to set up government, and God is ultimately in charge of the governments that rule the United States.
And if you misbehave and you turn away from God, then you will, the land will be taken away from you and given to someone else.
So given that, here the Latter-day Saints found themselves increasingly persecuted by the government. And, you know, the things that happened before this revelation was written down, the White Horse one, you know, the church was disenfranchised. At one point, all the church property was seized. The brethren were in the underground. And here was this restoration and the rough stone cut out of the mountain that was rolling forth to take over the world. And it was getting beat up by the U.S. government. So you have this big dilemma where you have the Book of Mormon theology, which places the U.S. government as sort of divinely inspired, but here it is, it's always persecuting the church. So what's going to happen? Well, at some point, the naughty government people have to be punished for standing against the saints. And you see that thread come up in a lot of different things, and it's through and through here that the government is corrupt and the Constitution will hang by a thread, whatever the hell that means. And at some point, God's going to come and clean house.
Well, in the Book of Mormon, it's really common that a religious leader is also the leader of the government. So for Mormons, it's sort of expected that there would be some sort of theocracy. If God is in charge of the nation, then God should literally, like, be in charge of the nation.
Does anyone know what was going on in 1918 to cause Joseph F. Smith and this big repudiation of the thing? Because that's the thing that really struck me the most, I think, reading about this, is who cares? It's weird with the white horse and the red horse and all that stuff, but nothing has ever repudiated, like, we've already said that they've never repudiated the idea that the Constitution is going to hang by a thread. They've never said Joseph Smith didn't really prophesy that the saints would establish a kingdom in the Rocky Mountains. And I don't know that the red horse and the white horse and all that's any more weird than anything else involved in church history. I don't understand what the big deal was to, you know, strongly speak against this thing in 1918.
I think you could speculate that, you know, the war to end all wars is going on, or had it just ended by that point?
Yeah, there were two big things. Of course, the World War One, the armistice was signed in 1918, but I think America entered the fight in 1917. So that's when it became, you know, clear what was going on. And it's hard for us. World War II was horrific, but World War I was just beyond horrific. I mean, there were battles with because for a little bit of war history, you know, they had the trenches, and they had these old generals who'd been fighting field battles in the 19th century, and they would just charge troops into these Gatling guns, and just tens of thousands of people would die in a single day. And it was just this bloody, bloody thing. It was just awful. But the other thing that happened in 1918 was the flu epidemic,
right?
In which there were the death toll was humongous, and it affected all through the West, where a lot of Western kids, because farmers sort of got a pass on fighting, so we didn't get as affected in the Mormon corridor by World War I, although, you know, we were obviously reading the papers and seeing what was going on, and here was this hellacious war going on overseas. But then the flu epidemic hits, and you can read a lot of books coming out from the time and shortly thereafter that this end of days rhetoric, you know, it ebbs and flows. You know, during the height of the Cold War, during the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of that rhetoric in the church, and it sort of died down. And during this time was another time when there was a lot of that rhetoric. So this revelation would have played into that. And I think the brethren were seeing it gain more and more traction, and we're saying, okay, we have to do something about it now.
And isn't this sort of a perfect backdrop to comment on the myopia of the fatalism that so many of the members of the church, of the modern church, have, and the rhetoric that you hear about, you know, things are worse than they have ever been, and the signs of the times are out there, and, you know, these are the end times, things are so terrible. I mean, think of being in 1918, you know, before medicine had taken a quantum leap, you know, with the things that you just talked about going on. I mean, you might have a real reason to wonder whether the end of the world was coming. I mean, and here we sit fat and happy in 2012, and, you know, some people act like things are worse than they've ever been, and in most ways they're better than they've ever been.
Yeah, you know, when people say that to me, yeah, that's an excellent point. I hate hearing that argument. Oh, things are going really bad. Anybody who thinks that's true, I invite you to read one book, A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century by Barbara Tuchman. The 1300s were miserable. I mean, it was just awful. And anybody who says, yeah, we're living in the worst time ever, I sometimes ask those people, okay, what year do you want to go back and live in? Because there's always been war. There's always been famine. There's always been bloodshed. That's just something that's been with us for a long time. And that's why revelations like these can be so powerful, is that every generation can read the same text for 2,000 years and say, oh, this is about us. I mean, how many times have people retold the book of Revelation in their own time? This isn't a new practice. It's always been that way. They've always looked at it and said, this is us. It's describing us.
Right, and they've all been wrong.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, even with this particular revelation, the Constitution will hang by a thread. I mean, in the research that I did, you can go through and see that the leaders of the church have been saying this since 1850, and they continue to say it up until, you know, almost the modern day. And because John said, that who even knows what that means? you can use that as an example. You know, the Lord told Joseph Smith the Constitution would hang by a thread, and you can see that in this particular time because of this. So it can be used kind of in a manipulative way to support whatever political agenda that you have.
Well, and I was going to say, it's not just that you can read this into what's, you know, happening today or other things that are fatalistic or that are end timesy, but you almost have to. And I think it necessarily leads to some of the nonsense that you see where, you know, I mean, just the things I see on Facebook and other places about, you know, Obama is destroying our country. Not just I disagree with him, but he's leading us, you know, down this terrible primrose path. You know, if you believe that these are the end times and that things are going to get progressively worse, and that's the story arc, then you've got to look around and figure out what those bad things are. And so pornography gets focused on, you know, whoever the current president, if he's a Democrat, gets focused on. And it's not just that, and it's not just that they get focused on in a small way, but it's elevated to this incredibly high level of these are the most terrible things that are happening. And we have to, you know, address them as though, you know, Satan himself is behind them. Because if you believe that this, you know, the end of the world is coming and things are getting worse, you're forced to find something to fit that storyline, aren't you?
Yeah. And you know, what's funny is you never hear them talk about, like, the Constitution is a legal document. And most people can't even tell you what's in the Constitution, right? They, at best, they think about the Bill of Rights. I mean, which is sort of part of it's the amendments to the Constitution. But, you know, they talk about the Constitution. Everybody should go out and read the Constitution. It's a great document, but it doesn't say what you think it says. And there are people who will quote sort of, like the Declaration of Independence or you know, something like that for the Constitution. But you're right. When people talk about the Constitution hang by a thread, you never hear them talk about, like, Dred Scott or, you know, the Patriot Act or things that really interfered with constitutional rights. You know, they're always talking about, like, the latest thing that Glenn Beck is hammering on about.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. And we've got three lawyers on the line, so I don't want to say that I'm, you know, against the Constitution, but if you actually, you're making a good point, John, if you actually go back and look at what the Constitution itself enshrined, you know, it really wasn't in some ways it was politically, horrible for people. I mean, it was a leap forward from where we were at before, but, you know, the three fifths of a person,
right.
You know, women don't have any rights whatsoever. I mean, there's horrible things that are enshrined in the Constitution, which if that part of it hangs by a thread, maybe it's not so bad. And then on the other hand, there's parts of the Constitution which 5 years after the Constitution was ratified were pretty much just thrown out the window. I mean, none of the founding fathers, if they looked at the state of the country 50 years later, would think, oh yeah, that's pretty much what we meant. That's what we all meant by the Constitution at the time. I mean, it was a snapshot of what was going on. And for people now in 2012 to think that we're living in, you know, that this vestige of what the founding fathers intended is still here. I mean, we've gone so far past what the original Constitution says. It's ridiculous. I mean.
Well, and all of the lawyers on, you know, the line will, I probably agree that one of the best things about our, you know, constitutional and, you know, Republican little R government is that you have, you know, a high court of the land that can arbitrate disputes over what the Constitution says and what the laws say. Now go look at the Constitution and find where that is provided for.
Right.
Because it's not in there. it isn't in there. That was a case that came later. Oh, and what was that? Was that Marbury versus Madison that established that?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Knowlton, the clown John that Marshall. What I'm talking about, the artist who has
Knowlton. Yeah.
What is his name?
John Knowlton, I think.
Yeah, Marbury versus Madison is actually one of the documents that he's got there laying on the ground as an example of judicial excess, that at some point in the past the Constitution got ruined by deciding that there would be judicial review. That's just an aside. But
for our friends listening at home, he is the LDS painter who likes to paint these collages of all these political figures standing, and his one that got him booted out of BYU was
his painting.
His paintings. He has President Obama standing on the Constitution, surrounded by all these founding fathers, like pleading with him to stop. And I think that's the painting you're referring to.
Yeah, and it's probably fair to make the point that I don't think that we're necessarily talking about the institutional church, feels that way, or even that most Mormons feel that way. But that's the kind of nonsense that comes out of this, at least at the edges, and maybe less at the edges than people would be comfortable admitting.
Well, this might be skipping towards the end, but it probably applies here. This is why this revelation is so important. Putting aside whether it's from 1890 or it's from, 1843, these ideas have been ever present and fuel the present political climate, because this idea that really dovetails into modern neoconservatism is ever present in Mormonism. And with the I'm a Mormon campaign, the church is trying to portray itself as very broad-minded. But if you go to any standard average sacrament meeting, especially in the West, these sort of people who speak of the Constitution this way and are openly hostile towards even just Democrats, it's in every single ward. And I think there's this doctrinal foundation for it in elements like the White Horse.
And in a lot of places, I think they control the conversations and control the discourse, even if they're not an overwhelming majority there.
So let's go into a little bit more into it. Of course, it doesn't just talk about the Constitution hanging by a thread. It gets surprisingly specific. And I think especially during the Red Scare, this really played right into that narrative, because it says in the Revelation that England and France are now bitter enemies, but they'll become allied together to stop the Russians.
Not just the Russians, but the Tsar.
Yes. Now let's go back in time, because here's our first anachronism. And Zilpha's getting ready to argue with me on this. In 1840, first of all, you have to understand, let's go way back in history. The Angles were there minding their own business on the island that they had taken from the people who were there before. And then the Normans invade in 1066. And the Normans are basically French people. And the Normans were the aristocracy after that. They set up the kingship, and it sort of was the foundation of modern day, English, royalty and parliament and all that stuff grew out of that Norman invasion. And it was for a long, long time that the language of the courts in England was French. But the only reason I bring this up is the English and the French have long had this off-again, on-again relationship where they both kind of are attacking each other and allied with each other, and it's back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. That's why something like that, a revelation that says – you could have a revelation that says England and France will be allied or they'll be enemies, and it's always kind of true and kind of false. But for our purposes, in 1840, there was no conflict, and there hadn't been for many years, at least a heated conflict, between the English and the French, not since the American Revolution. And in fact, in 1853 to 1856 was the Crimean War, and England and France were allied against Russia, which is something that would have been in the mind of Rushton. Now, I have to wag my finger again at the apologists, because they talk about the Franco-Prussian War, but they kept leaving out the Crimean War. And the Crimean War would have set the stage for this revelation, and it would have played into the narrative that Brigham Young, of course, we all know from the Doctrine and Covenants, we've talked about in this podcast, we have the revelation about the war on the slavery issue starting in South Carolina. But everybody could see that thing coming. And Brigham Young taught openly that the world, that the United States was going to have this war, it was going to fight, and it was going to fall. And I mentioned that at the top of the podcast. And that the church kingdom would take its place. So here you have like the Crimean War where you're seeing the European powers fighting against each other. And of course, they keep going back to war, you know, during Joseph Smith times, you see the Napoleonic Wars and the Crimean Wars and the Franco-Prussian War and all that stuff that leads into World War I. So Americans are sitting back watching all that stuff happening. So it's not a far stretch to see the seeds of all those things that are going on. And then you have the Bolshevik Revolution, of course, the communist takeover in Russia, and then on up to the 20th century history, which we all know so well. So it's not that far of a stretch to identify, you know, England and France fighting against the Russians.
Well, and also not far-fetched to think that, you know, the United States might become embroiled in something, you know, that would cause it to lose its government or to fall. I mean, you know, we all look back, you know, being people who were born in the 20th century, thinking of our nation being a great power, but that didn't really come about until the First World War, and didn't truly, you know, get inked on the pages of history until the Second World War. So writing from the perspective of the 19th century, we were still kind of a bit player on the stage, world stage.
Yes, I agree. And that thing tends to be focused on in here, but there's some other crazy stuff in here that gets sort of passed over, although I remember hearing this stuff as a child. I like the fact that the Greek Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church will eventually come together in their decline and be united. So for all of you watching for the end of the world, until the two churches heal their schism, I think I was taught that in seminary that had to happen. And I don't know of another source for that besides this.
Wow, I don't remember hearing that.
I never heard that.
The other thing you see coming up in here, which is a theme of early speaking, this leads credence to this to me, is the elevated status of the blood of the English. This is something that especially Heber C. Kimball was really fond of talking about, that the English people were of a higher order of personhood. They were more whitesome and delightsome, and that they will rule for 1,000 years, it says in here, and they'll have this place of supremacy. And during the 19th century, it seemed that way, but 20th century sort of kicked that one in the shorts.
See, and when I read that, I thought that actually argued against that part of it being something that came from Joseph Smith, because Edwin Rushton was born in England. And so, I mean, it at least just occurred to me that if this is an old man who, you know, towards the end of his life is recording this and saying, oh, you know, England is superior because it has more of the blood of Israel and it's, you know, going to continue to be the greatest power. That, to me at least, makes more sense coming out of the mouth of an English expat than it does coming out of Joseph Smith's mouth.
I like the part where the prophecy says that, it's right after the part you just mentioned, John, that England and Germany and Norway and Denmark and Switzerland, all these countries have a considerable amount of the blood of Israel among them, which must be gathered out, and that they're going to lead and throw off the Catholic power. But then he says, the nobility knows that the gospel is true, but it has not pomp enough and grandeur and influence for them to embrace it. Yet they are proud and will not acknowledge the kingdom of God or come see it until they have the power, until the power it will have. And then it goes on to talk about the white horse and the red horse being gathered in the mountains. But, I just think it's hilarious that the, prophecy assumes that, you know, the leaders of the world, they really know that the church is true and they just can't be humble enough to accept it.
Yeah. Well, and did anybody else as a kid ever hear that either Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan had actually taken the discussions and accepted the church, and they knew it was true, but they just couldn't, you know, be a member publicly? I don't remember where I heard that, but I know I heard that when I was.
I thought that was Shakira.
I thought it was
Lionel Richie.
I thought it was Elvis. I thought that the Osmonds gave Elvis a Book of Mormon, and that's what he's reading on the can when he croaked, I thought.
I actually have heard that too. I have heard
See,
that.
I don't make this shit up. This is out there.
Somebody
or is that
did though.
Snoop Dogg reading the Book of Mormon. Why not Elvis?
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, so
they're all Mormons.
Can we talk about the red horse for a minute here?
Yeah. So,
or the different.
We haven't talked about the horses. Why don't you tell us about the horses?
Okay, so, you know, from my dummy perspective on this, there's four horse colors that are relevant. There's the white horse, which is clearly the church or, you know, the kingdom of God. There's the pale horse that's mentioned, and that's the rest of the United States. There's the red horse, which it's a little bit unclear, but I think there's enough evidence to me that the red horse is referring to the Native Americans. And then there's the black horse. And the black horse, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the black horse is associated with the other countries of the world, that are going to combine against the white horse, against the United States, and that this is all kind of an apocalyptic, scenario. Is that a good overview?
Yeah, and I think to your point, it's not very clear.
none of it's very clear, but the one sentence after the quote that I read a minute ago, there's a quote in here that says, "Peace and safety in the Rocky Mountains will be protected by the guardians, the white horse, or excuse me, the guardians, the white and red horses." So the fact that the prophecy here refers to the red horses being in the Rocky Mountains, I'm thinking that this is a pretty clear indication that it's, and again, with the color red, that it's the Native Americans that they're referring to. This would tie in with the Book of Mormon prophecies that the, you know, the Lamanites would align themselves with the church and that they would come back into the fold. And it also kind of goes to, the idea, at least in Utah, that the, Indians could be used kind of as the battering ram of the church when they had to keep out enemies, you know, like for things like with Mountain Meadows or, happened all through Brigham Young's career where they would utilize the American Indians to do things that they needed to. Not that that had happened by 1843, but, I think that's what's referred to by the red horse.
Yeah.
I agree, Jesse. When I read this section here about the black horse, I thought it was specifically referring to black people because it talks about that the black horse will flee to the invaders because they have a fear of becoming slaves again. And then when I saw red horse, I just immediately kind of thought that the horses were aligned with the color of the races and the apologists in the Fair articles. We don't know what the red horse or the black horse mean.
Right.
But yeah, I agree. That's what I thought it was too.
Yeah, it's probably like in the Book of Abraham where you see a black guy and he's automatically a slave, right?
But what do you guys make of this language, though, where it talks about England having the red coat and that they conquer wherever they go with the red coat and that, you know, when history is written, we will see what the reason for that color was and talks about the lion and the unicorn of England. That at least suggested to me that maybe the red horse is England.
Well, I thought that at first, and I read it again. I think it goes to the fact that the author is arguing for the superiority of the Israeli blood or whatever it is, the pure blood in the English people. And they are so much better than, and it basically even says it, they're so much better than everybody else. They can go into a battlefield wearing red coats and they're still going to kick ass.
The Lord took the best blood of the nations and planted them on the small islands now called England and Great Britain and gave them power in the nations for 1,000 years and their power will continue with them that they may keep the balance of power and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then it talks about how, hey, they're wearing these red coats and it makes them really easy to shoot, but they're still winning all their battles.
Can I jump in with another comment on the black horse? Because my reading was similar to what Troy's was, that the fear of becoming slaves suggested that they were talking about blacks or slaves or former slaves. And I don't want to not comment on that it then says that they would go armed with British bayonets and the doing of the black horse will be terrible. So if the black horse is actually black people, and who would be the very most savage of anybody? Well, of course, it's black people, which I think just points to the racism of whichever time it was written in, whether that's really 1843 or later.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with this reading, and I want to go back and underline the Indian thing because it was a very prominent idea, and it's sort of been buried now, that that we were just a little bit off, that it was just about to happen that the Mormons are going to convince the Indians that this was the one true church. They were all going to convert in mass. What is it you were reading to me yesterday, Zilpha, about there was some sort of raid and the guy had written, I guess we're not going to convert the Indians this year.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was when the Saints were heading from Nauvoo to Salt Lake. It's in Brigham Young's journal. And the Indians kept stealing their cattle. And so Brigham said, don't allow the Indians into your tents anymore because they'll steal from you as they're eating a meal from you. I guess we're not going to convert the Indians this year.
This year.
The Lamanites this year, yeah.
I was just reading the famous quote by Spencer Kimball from 1960 conference when he says that the Indians, the Navajo, are turning white. And of course the Indian placement program during all those years up until the 70s. And I think when that thing finally blew up is when the idea sort of died. But the idea that these Indians are just about to convert and they are going to, you know, be the fist that drives this physical conquering. Cause I think implicit in this idea is not just the spiritual, hey, we're going to go out and convert the world. We're going to give them the six discussions. We're going to get baptized and become good Mormons. But there is a time period coming when we are going to kick ass and everybody's going to get their upcomings. And I think that sort of underlying message is really popular among a certain segment of the LDS population.
Oh, yeah.
Are we ready to talk about gold?
Let's do it.
So this spends a lot of time talking about precious metals and and gold, surprisingly. The apologist or actually, Dwayne Crowther wrote about this a lot. He was really excited about this revelation. He gave it legitimacy. And one of the things he said is, hey, nobody knew in 1843 that the Rocky Mountains were full of minerals and ore. Yeah, like that's a really hard idea to put together. But he says that's a validation of this revelation that, you know, of course the gold strike in 1849, and then they find these things. This revelation goes further in saying there's so much gold in Zion and that the only place you'll be able to bank is England and Salt Lake City.
Well, that's because the rest of the world's banks are going to collapse. My dad quotes that one a lot. He really believes that. He's got his stash of gold. I'm not going to say where, but he's all ready for all the banks to collapse, and then he'll be ready with his gold.
Well, and that's why if you listen to any of those overnight programs, that there's saturation of the companies that sell gold or, you know, the coins or the different things, because all of the, you know, conspiracy theorists and people that are watching for black helicopters, you know, believe that too, and they're hoarding gold because that's exactly what they think.
But doesn't this revelation say, I won't ask, I'll read it to you. You will see the gold shoveled up like sand. Gold will be of little value then, even in mercantile capacity. So there is, for really right-wing Mormons, they not only get their one-year food supply, they stock gold and ammunition. And that's not a joke. If you've been in Utah and Idaho, they honest to goodness stock guns and gold. So, I always ask these guys, because I'm, as Zilpha pointed out, I'm related to them, what do you plan on doing with the gold? I tell them that I stockhold chocolate
paper.
And toilet paper. Because I can barter with that, right? But what are you going to do with the gold?
Who wants gold when they're starving and they need chocolate?
And toilet paper.
I'm just positive that there is a dream mind connection to this. I haven't been able to.
The dream mind people.
Go ahead. I was just going to say the closest that I could get is that if you go to their webpage, which they now actually call it the Relief Mine, they have the White Horse Prophecy very prominently figured on their webpage. And they have a copy of this, that we've had read, and they highlight the portions that talk about the gold and the silver. So I don't know if that played into, you know, the original guy's thinking when, you know, Moroni visited him, but certainly his, descendants or whoever's picked up the ball and run with it have bought into it and are pointing to that.
Yeah. I mean, this is one that they quote all the time. So there's three threads coming together in this one. First of all, the Saints will flee to the Rocky Mountains for safety. The Rocky Mountains will be the place of constitutional or lawfulness that the rest of the world will have to turn to towards us after their laws fail. And of course, the banking systems, the mercantilism or whatever will be established here. And England, of course, we're throwing a bone to England for some reason. So I think that kind of sums up a lot of Mormon thought there, that there's the rest of the world is unsafe, you know, and, we have more financial acumen, that we are rewarded financially for our righteousness. And that we have a special, insular, better than everybody else society.
And we're in a position to survive any kind of apocalypse that could come against us.
And it's the perfect intersection of Mormon exceptionalism and Mormon fatalism.
Yeah. No one's ever been able to explain to me, given like the plan of salvation, why surviving the apocalypse has any advantage whatsoever. I've never been able to puzzle that out of any of this stuff. Like, what's the point in surviving the apocalypse?
A thousand years of doing temple work doesn't sound attractive, John.
But aren't they going to start resurrecting the dead at that point? I mean, you know, so like dying doesn't necessarily invalidate your temple recommend.
No, because they'll have to wait. The bad ones have to wait until the last resurrection after.
So you want to survive if you're a sinner. I see.
Yeah, all things are going to be restored. Maybe polygamy will come back.
All right.
I think we should point out the part in the Revelation here where it says that there's a land beyond the Rocky Mountains that will be invaded by the heathen Chinese unless great care and protection be given.
So, oh my gosh.
If anybody liked the movie Red Dawn from the 80s, they're doing a remake of it where the Chinese are going to be invading. It's coming out this year. So I think that might be, you know, part of the Revelation here. The Chinese are invade the U.S.
Yeah, that's in the last paragraph, which it gets sort of crazy, and it basically says all the United States will now be Zion.
Yeah.
And you know, which is sort of contradictory to the rest of the prophecy. But then everybody else will be Gog and Magog, and be led by the Russian Tsar, and you know. So I think you pointed this out before, but you know, a lot of people read the communism into this, but really, it's still on the old Russian model. It doesn't say anything about any sort of economic philosophy war here at all.
Well, apparently, what would happen is that there would be a terrible revolution. That's what it says, and that there would be no main government left, and every honest person would flee to the Rocky Mountains. And while all kinds of terrible things were going on, including murders and rapes, and then the other countries would all fight against Zion, the White Horse, and the White Horse would win, and therefore kind of take over the United States for its own, the whole thing, because everything else had fallen,
right?
And so then they gather their strength in the Rocky Mountains and then spread out.
Well, and in which DNC section is it that has the I should know, we covered it, that has the South Carolina thing?
Because
remember, that revelation says the war will start in South Carolina, then it will slowly grow until it fills the entire world, which of course has never happened. But, you know, so these threads go way, way back to the 1830s where the Mormons are talking about this. And I was going to bring this up earlier, but my favorite thing to read in Mormon history is the Evening and Morning Star, which was the newspaper that was run for like 18 months in Zion when they first got there, because every little thing that happens, like they talk about cholera here or malaria there, or there's a little breakout, or there's
an
earthquake, everything is given this apocalyptic zeal to it, which is, see, the whole world is about to fall down around us. And especially those early saints, it's been de-emphasized in church history, but those guys were just waiting for everything to just explode. And they would go on missions in, you know, 1832, 1834 and saying, you have to flee to Kirtland, or you have to flee to Missouri, because it's it's not very long before everything will be sacked here. And they would even tell people, sell your farms at a loss. Because it was always right there. And these people who were during that time just thrived on that apocalyptic zeal. And it's something that has flamed out a bit, but it's still there. It's because it's part of the foundation of the faith.
Well, isn't that what Boyd K. Packer's comment, what was it, the last conference or the one before, was directed to when he said, you know, that the second coming is not yet, you know, you won't be till your grandchildren or not even till your great grandchildren. But what would prompt him or motivate him to say something like that, unless it were that there were members of the church who were believing that it was so imminent that they were, you know, making, you know, foolish life choices as a result of that. So I think it definitely still exists.
I'll give you an example. This is from my life. It was a friend that I had at work, and there was a conference talk on the importance of food storage. This was about 7 or 8 years ago, and he promptly, I'm not kidding, and I can give names and dates. This is firsthand. It's not a secondhand story. He promptly, the next Monday, cashed out his 401k, stopped paying anything into that, and he didn't make tons of money at a big LDS family, and they just started stockpiling food. It's been 7 years now. All of that food has spoiled. None of it's good anymore. So he pulled out of his 401k in his late 20s when he should have been paying into it. Because to him, the prophet had commanded us to stockpile food. Something was going to happen. And I don't remember the talk from the time, but they said something like, there will be a time when it'll be too late, you know, to.
And it's like the ark. And if you don't have your food storage, it'll be like you never got on the ark during the flood.
Yeah. I think it was, because I still attend and go to conference every 6 months. I think that this was a talk President Hinckley gave in priesthood session where he said something to the effect of, I feel inspired to remind everyone of the story of Joseph in Egypt and when he interpreted the dream of the guys in prison or the Pharaoh's dream of the 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine, and you need, you know, I'm inspired to tell you this. And he didn't really come out and say, sell everything you own and buy food. In fact, he didn't say that at all, but I can see where someone could have interpreted it that way.
Have you ever given pause to think about, you know, food shelf life is not that good. Nutritional value starts to decline. And the Utah State University they have a department that studies this thing, probably because of the zeal for it in Utah. And they've done all sorts of interesting research. We should bring them on sometime. But the billions of dollars over the past 70 or 80 years that have been wasted, utterly wasted in Mormon food hoarding. It just boggles the mind. If you are in Utah, you can drive around and every 3 or 4 miles there is an emergency preparedness store, or, you know, selling MREs and whistles. I don't know what people are going to put whistles for during the apocalypse, but that you can buy them there. And all this stuff. But all of that food that Mormons have been, all that wheat that just was feeding mice, you know, because I've seen the way people eat. It's virtually impossible to really rotate all your food. If you have enough for a year's worth of food storage, the only thing you can do is hoard it, throw it out, and replace it. And just if that resource had been put somewhere else to like really wiping out hungry, if the prophet said, here, we're all willing to go hungry, if Jesus is coming, because we know he's going to save us. So take all your food storage and let's wipe out hunger in the United States. If those billions of dollars were devoted to that, and that's really the danger of things like this white horse prophecy. It turns people cuckoo and they start doing things that don't make any sense.
Because the whole thing doesn't make any sense.
Well, look, there was a friend of mine, another friend who had actually moved out to Utah from New Orleans about 6 months before Katrina hit. And when that first came, he was like saying, oh, you know, lucky all the LDS people had their food storage. But then it turned out, I don't know if you guys followed the stories, it wiped everything out. You know, if you had anything in your basement, it did you no good. You know, having wheat under swampy water doesn't help anybody. All right.
Yeah, I will say, go ahead, Matt.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in defense of food storage, I do think that just as a practical matter, it makes sense to have a few months of food storage just in case you lose your employment or something. But, I mean, you do need to buy food that you actually eat and that you rotate the stock. Because I hear what you're saying, John. I know you can, and there are companies that you just buy the, you know, the whole wheat that is in these 5 or 10 gallon containers, and then it just sits there, and eventually the weevils eat it because you are never going to use it for anything. I just, you know, but we do have a few months worth of food storage just because you never know what's going to happen in your life.
Well, and I guess you could argue financially it's better if you don't have to go to the grocery store every time you need a can of beans. But has there ever been a time in the United States where you wouldn't have been better off to have that in cash reserves? If you fall on hard times, probably in the United States right now, and you're individually, because a lot of them will justify it and say, okay, look, people lose their jobs, people have individual hardship. It's not necessarily apocalyptic. It can be individually. But food, there's food banks all over the United States. There's that sort of thing. Food is oftentimes the easiest thing to get. I would dare say that up till now, and I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but you would have always been better off to have that in cash reserves. But, I mean, that's just me.
Well, I think that probably a 72-hour kit is a good idea.
Oh, having food on stock, having a 72-hour kit.
Having some water.
But when you start talking about a year, or because there are a lot of Uber Mormons that say a year is for pansies. What you really need is 7 years. And I would say that can't even be done, you know.
Yeah. Well, and if you live somewhere in the desert, which a lot of Mormons do in the Intermountain West, the idea of, you know, if things got bad enough to where your most important items were, you know, your wheat and your food and your ammunition, I mean, you're screwed on water.
Yeah.
Like what are you going to do when there's no water? And if there is water, then guess what? They can grow crops and feed people because there's farms around every major city in the country.
Right. There's really three things you need if there's a long-term emergency. You need clean water. You need fuel to heat. You know, whatever circumstance you are, fuel, and you need your medication. And they never talk about those three things because you can't store a year's worth of fuel. You can't store a year's worth of food, of water.
Well,
You can store the fuel.
There's people here that use their swimming pools to say that that's going to be their water source, and that they buy special filtration kits that can take out the chlorine and other minerals and chemicals that are in the pool water.
Wow.
I'm delicious. Sort of, I'm glad we took this detour because it circles us back to one of the underlying things about this that I think is important. There's this idea of persecution in the church and upcomings that Mormons are looked down upon, Mormons believe. And I think most people are indifferent to Mormons, but of course they get made fun of sometimes because of polygamy and other stuff like that. But Mormons believe that there'll become this time when they will emerge as the true leaders of the world, that everyone will recognize them for the talent they have. And underlying this food storage thing, is this idea that they will have all this food, all this protection, when nobody else does.
And people will turn to them for help.
Well, and why they don't think that hungry people will do all sorts of things. I mean, to have food in a time of hunger is not a good position to be in, you know.
that's why you need the ammunition.
Well, and there's some great recent evidence of that persecution complex. Everybody's seen the relatively new Pew poll that came out, right, where they did a poll of I don't know how many, but they'd sort of filtered them down to all be sort of true believing or active Mormons. And one of the things that shook out of that poll is that the Mormons said that they were, I don't know if the word was persecuted or maybe it was discriminated against, that by a wide margin that Mormons were more discriminated against than black people were in America.
I mean,
that's just, I don't know, I can't get my head around that.
But they also, 20% said they believed in reincarnation, so there's that.
I think they misunderstood the question. There's definitely a persecution complex.
Could have been multiple mortal probations, I don't know.
They probably thought that they were being asked about resurrection.
All right, the last thing in here that I want to focus on, the second to last paragraph, I'm just going to read it verbatim because I think it's fun. The temple in Jackson County, Missouri, will be built in that generation. The saints will think that there will not be time to build it, but with all the help you can receive, you can put up a great temple quickly. You will have all the gold, silver, and precious stones you need, for these things will only be for the beautifying of the temple. Also, all the skilled mechanics you want and the 10 tribes of Israel will help build it. When you see the land bound with iron, you may look forward to Jackson County. And we're going back. Which is, if you go out to Independence, there's a whole bunch of Samoans out there. The reason they're there is because they were converted to the Mormon Church in the Samoan Islands and went to Jackson County to be ready for Jesus to come back. So this idea is alive and well. And, we don't have any of our Zion contingency on today, but they'll tell you in the church, there's a bunch of nutballs out there ready for Jesus to return to his summer home.
Has anyone ever received or seen an email that circulated? This I got it from a family member shortly after the stock market took a dive in 2008, where there's some, it's attributed to a general authority, you know, the nameless general authority, and he supposedly gives it in a priesthood leadership meeting of a state conference and says something to the effect of, you know, there's going to come a time when we're going to have a special meeting and we're going to say, okay, everybody who has their year's worth of food storage can stay in here. Everybody else, you're dismissed from the meeting. And then those who are still there are given the logistics of returning to Jackson County. I don't know if anyone's seen this but me.
I haven't seen that one, but I have heard that the mountains are going to open up. This is what another thing my dad believes. And only the people who are prepared with their food storage will be allowed in to the sanctuary of the mountain.
Yeah, in the tent cities. It's sort of like the
I'm not exactly
the evangelical
sure what
it, idea of the rapture, where the prepared Mormons get ushered off to this special place and the unprepared Mormons are left to suffer the calamity. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think before we end, we should mention, do we already mention about Ezra Taft Benson talking about this concept in conference?
Which concept?
No, let's do that.
Okay, so, well, Ezra Taft Benson, you know, he wrote, what's that book? What's that big bad book he wrote about communism?
Ezra Taft Benson?
Yeah. Didn't he write that?
The Naked Communist?
Yeah.
That was Skousen.
Oh, Skousen. All right, never mind about that. But he was one who believed that the communists were basically going to wreak havoc upon the United States. But so he was afraid. He said in conference in 1961, in connection with attack on the United States, the Lord told Prophet Joseph Smith, there would be an attempt to overthrow the country by destroying the Constitution. Joseph Smith predicted that the time would come when the Constitution would hang, as it were, by a thread, and at that time, this people will step forth and save it from the threatened destruction. So that was given in conference.
Yeah, so this is why I don't think, I mean, at some point, the provenance of the White Horse prophecy doesn't matter, because there's people like Brigham Young or Ezra Taft Benson that have essentially ratified what is in the supposed White Horse prophecy to the point where it's entered the Mormon mindset as much as it would if the prophecy were genuine. So I think that is kind of a moot point. In terms of its effect on Mormon thought.
And if you want to, and there aren't that many, you know, really contemporary mentions of it, but as I was searching through looking for the most recent mentions of it, you can on the church's website find the June 1976 edition of the Ensign. And, you know, that series that they used to have, I Have a Question. There's a question in there that's, what do we know about the purported statement of Joseph Smith? You love that they use purported. Purported statement of Joseph Smith that the Constitution would hang by a thread. And it goes through and, as you might expect, sort of says, well, a lot of that you know, White Horse Red Horse stuff we don't believe, but clearly we think it will hang by a thread. And definitely there's, you know, all of these statements by general authorities that support the idea that the church will, you know, step in and save it. And I mean, it's, you know, like I always agree with what John says, that there's no shelf life on these things. So it's not been repudiated. And then there it is in the church's formal publication and on their website. So I,
right. And apparently, Orrin Hatch thinks he's one of the elders to save the Constitution because
well, he's mentioned it a couple times, right?
Well, the one I saw was his interview with Glenn Beck, where Senator Hatch says, "Well, let me tell you something. I believe the Constitution is hanging by a thread. I've been fighting to save it for all 32 years I've been in the Senate, and I think anybody who looks at it knows I've been in almost every fight that's been saving the Constitution." So apparently he sees himself fulfilling that prophecy.
Well, I saw that he had... Go ahead.
Oh, I keep cutting you off, Matthew. What I'd really like to see is Harry Reid use that and see what would happen. Because, you know, he's a faithful member of the church, a priesthood holder, an elder of Israel, and a Democrat that most conservative Mormons consider to be, you know, an embarrassment to the church. And I'd really love to see him say, "Hey, you know, I am one of the elders that's here to save the Constitution." See what the fallout would be.
Yeah, and Zilpha, back to Orrin Hatch, in 1999, he was running for President of the United States, and he gave a quote then that he said, "I've never seen it as bad as it is now, that the Constitution is literally hanging by a thread." And I love it when people use literally, and they really mean figuratively.
Right, right. Well, I can just imagine the...
We all remember 1999 when the Constitution was hanging by a thread and things were worse than it had ever been, right? We all have a clear recollection of that.
Well, you know, Y2K was breathing down
yes.
our necks.
Well, it's right around the corner.
Yeah, this stuff comes up all the time, and then there's repudiation. But I want to make clear that oftentimes I think the White Horse prophecy is unduly brought up, and it might be a straw man. Because, I mean, you think about, like, the kerfuffle with Rex Rommel or whatever his name was up in Idaho Falls, who he was running for office and he distributed this leaflet to all the people, hit the papers, where he basically used the language, you know, we needed to the elders, he was calling the elders to save the Constitution and the Constitution to hang by a thread. And he, you know, he basically breached full on, and he owned it. He said, "This is, the LDS people have to come forward and take over the government," basically. But I think what happens is whenever they use the language Constitution hang by a thread, the apologists swoop in, say, "White Horse prophecy repudiated, end of story." But I think we've established here that hanging by a thread predates White Horse prophecy and is full on Mormon doctrine, and that it's been validated by several LDS authorities. So even though that appears in the White Horse, it is not the source for that. Nor is the fact that somebody said White Horse is bunk. Does it get rid of that doctrine?
You know, I would be curious to know from Troy and Jesse how much run this is getting in local churches, because Mitt Romney has been way too clever to get drawn out on this. I think the only thing I found by him was in 2007 when he was running before, that he just said it was a matter of speculation. But I've got to think that there are a lot of people who feel like Mitt's their boy, that he's going to be the guy riding in on the white horse. Are you guys getting any sense of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially contrasted with Obama right now. I mean, it's just...
Black horse.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, really, that's, you know, not that they would say it that way because they haven't read the white horse prophecy, but the, you know, he is just... destroying the Constitution, he's ruining everything, and that we're going to have, you know, a guy coming in that knows what he's doing and save the day. And yeah, I mean, Romney is huge here. It's just huge.
So go ahead.
I was just going to ask Jesse, you're in the corridor somewhere?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm on the East Coast, and I think that the wards here tend to be a little more liberal than the, or at least a little less conservative than the wards in the corridor. So I haven't it hasn't been an issue. Plus, I'm sort of a lifelong liberal, and I've been in my ward a long time, and people know that politically I'm not I'm not the typical Mormon, so they generally don't talk about that kind of stuff around me.
Hmm. You've browbeaten them into silence, have you?
Well, no, I just my wife usually I usually don't say anything. I just kind of get up and or just kind of move away when the conversation goes that way, or get up and leave Elder's Quorum or whatever. And my wife has talked to the other wives that, you know, you've made Troy feel bad. I didn't feel bad. It was a nice excuse to get out of Elder's Quorum, but so it's yeah, people generally, I don't think that I've browbeaten anybody. They just don't talk about it around me.
All right. So to sum up, I think the White Horse Prophecy is generally paraded around by fundamentalists and right-wingers in the church, which is why the brethren from time to time feel the necessity to repudiate it. But I will ask the panel here, and I'll challenge our listeners if they can come up with one. I don't see anything in this prophecy that's not in harmony, to use a LDS turn of phrase, that's not in harmony with teachings that come from other sources. There might be a little bit more detail here, but, you know, all the stuff on Russia you can find coming across the pulpit from Prophet, Seer, and Revelator Ezra Taft Benson and others during the 60s. So is there anything in here other than them repudiating the whole thing, saying this isn't valid, that doctrinally is unsound or can't be backed up from other sources?
I mean, I think that there are a lot of the specifics in there are not necessarily things that most people in the modern church would believe, but sort of the large story arcs of, you know, there being a gathering and the world's getting worse and Mormons are going to be the ones that are going to save the government. Now, that's the reason that this thing has continued to have life for so long, is because it is in harmony with all of those other things. It's easy to believe.
I agree.
Yeah, I think this was a point I made a little earlier, that's why I don't understand what the big fuss about, you know, or why the church is so interested in repudiating this. And even as in, if you look at Mormon doctrine, I was going to say as recently as, you know, in the 60s, McConkie talks about the White Horse Prophecy and says, you know, people that should know better have quoted this prophecy. And he quotes the Joseph F. Smith thing from 1918. But again, other than the thing being really strange, but not really any more strange than any of the other things we believe, it's not there's nothing in there that is false or that I think is all that, you know, damaging to the church. So I don't really understand what the big deal about it is.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like anything's at stake over it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think bottom line is it's likely the musings of an old guy who had some sort of conversation with Joseph Smith where he probably said some of these things. We know he did. And then he was incorporating the doctrinal teachings he'd heard for the last 50 or 60 years and then penned this masterpiece. And I think it's clear that it's probably not exactly the words of the prophet. It speaks to somebody who's looking back at some of those events like the Franco-Prussian War and the Crimean War and the Civil War and incorporating those into this revelation. And somebody who's looking toward the imminent demise of the nations. And so I think it is probably a faithful representation of common beliefs, and common teachings in the church, although it's not a revelation. For somebody like me who doesn't believe revelation is divine anyway, it has just as much merit in terms of understanding Mormon thought as even probably more so than a lot of things Joseph Smith came up with, because a lot of those were promptly abandoned by the church.
But I have to just argue with you a little bit about the idea that this isn't a big deal. Like, you don't understand why some Mormons and some church leaders would say, oh, well, this isn't a revelation. Because it sort of looks, I mean, if you've got somebody running for the presidency of the United States, like Romney, this can look kind of bad, almost like a conspiratorial idea of the Mormons.
I agree with that. But
it is sort of embarrassing.
My point is all these ideas can be found from more legitimate sources.
Oh, yeah. Those main ideas.
So
yeah.
All the conspiracy you're talking about is there, you know.
Right. But it is still embarrassing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think and we didn't point out either that the LDS newsroom released a statement where they said it's the church statement on White Horse Prophecy, where they said that it was not true and not in line with church doctrine. So I think in that sense, it gives the church an easy out to be able to denounce the whole thing and not have to get into the specifics of it. They can just say, oh, well, that prophecy, that isn't doctrinal. But then they can float the idea of the Constitution hanging by a thread, and they can kind of speak out of both sides of their mouth.
Right. Because go ahead.
Go ahead, John. Well, I was just going to say I'll quibble with Jesse just a little bit in that I don't think that the press release, and again, this just leaves lots of room for fundies and people who believe it. They don't come out and say that it's wrong. They don't say that it's incorrect. What they say is it's not been substantiated by historical research and is not embraced by church doctrine. So you could drive a truck through that hole that someday they could embrace it, or it could be historically substantiated. They're just saying it's not reliable, not that it's wrong. And if they think it's wrong, and again, there's at least ostensibly prophets, seers, and revelators at the top, they should just say so. But, you know,
they need to point out where it's wrong, because they're doing a sleight of hand. They're saying the provenance is off. We can't fully attribute this to Joe Smith, granted. And then they say, therefore, you know, it's not doctrinally sound. Well, what's not doctrinally sound about it? Because I can't find what's not doctrinally sound. I can find where they put more detail, but all those things are perfectly aligned with other teachings. And as an LDS person, you could say all of this could come to pass. There's nothing in here that says, nope, that can't be.
And I think that's why they leave it open. They probably look at it and think, well, maybe it could.
Well, I mean,
from a true believer's perspective.
Yeah, and most Mormons are never going to see this anyway. I mean, this is from the LDS newsroom, which anytime you see something on there, you know it's something that the church is saying to outsiders. It's an outgroup message. Anytime they want to tell the church members something, they do it in general conference or in the Ensign or something like that. But when they want to get something out to the media, they do it through this LDS newsroom, and then they don't say anything about it to the membership usually.
Right. It's another common apologist trick that goes on the top 10 stupid apologist trick thing, where they say, we have dealt with that. We don't want to talk about it anymore. It's been dealt with. And then they can refer to the newsroom article. Yeah. I agree. All right. Well, thanks for everybody who participated tonight. Our wonderful panel. Well, I've got my new outro. I'm trying to find. Oh, here it is.
Oh, you have a new outro.
Yes. The Mormon Expression Podcast is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Check us out at whitefieldseducational.org. The podcast is made possible through your generous support. Please consider a subscription today. This episode was directed by John Larson. Matthew Crowley was the producer. And Rich Rasmussen was the editor. Our theme music was by The Selden Plan. And as always, the discussion continues on our website at mormonexpression.com. Thanks, everybody.
That was lovely.
Beautiful.
Good night.
Good night.